and welcome to another episode of Downtime with the Cranston Public Library. We're a podcast for cool people who love libraries, where we talk about what we've been reading, what we've been watching, and what we've been loving. I'm your host, Taylor, in the branch librarian at the Oaklawn Branch Library, and my pronouns are she, her.
Hi, I'm Dennis Hilliard. I'm currently the director of the Rhode Island State Crime Laboratory. I've been in the business since 1980, so I got a lot of experience here, both in the laboratory at the University of Rhode Island, as well as a laboratory up in Providence doing forensic sciences. So I work, I've worked on cases, I've testified in court, and I also now administrate the laboratory on a day-to-day basis. We've grown from three people when I started. We're at 13 people right now. So we do quite a bit of work down at the university.
Hello, I'm Claire Mary Sweeney, and I'm a retired public school teacher and administrator who is now writing murder mysteries in South Kingstown, the South Kingstown mystery series. I used to write children's books set up in the Berkshires, but Rhode Islanders wanted Rhode Island books, so can't say no. So we now have our Rhode Island South County series. And right now there are six books in the series. One for each village in South Kingstown, and then another one for Westerly. I'm in the process of writing the seventh mystery, which will be spread out. I moved my character, Detective Lieutenant Carol Langley, from being a detective lieutenant on the South Kingstown Police Force. I moved her into the forensics lab at URI to give her more mobility so that we can use other settings. And that's how Dennis and I got together.
All right. So a little bit later in the show, we'll talk more about that and how both of your paths kind of crossed. But before we get into that, let's start off as we always do with what have you been reading?
I'm not reading a lot of books, but I read a lot online, mostly political stuff. I keep abreast of the crime scenes in not only Rhode Island, but throughout the country. I'm a part of several different national organizations that deal with forensics on a regular basis. So I need to stay abreast of what's going on in the field. My favorite books are fantasy books. Lord of the Rings is a big thing. The Harry Potter series is another one. I do catch them on TV and always analyze what's in the book versus what's in the movie and say, oh, they missed something or they added something. So it's kind of my background, seeing what's different. You know, especially those pictures I do with my grandchild now, what's different? Which one is different? So try to figure that out. So that's my little background on that.
Let's see. Right now, my last book I finished yesterday, and it was on Timothy McVeigh and the beginning of the white extremist groups, how that started. And I have been doing research on that area for my next book. So I'm very interested in it. I listen to podcasts, it's The Sisters-in-Law, which deals with issues of legal politics and legalities in politics, all about Agatha. I love reading analysis of Agatha Christie books and taking them apart. I like that golden age of mystery set back in the 1920s. I've been watching Gail Marsh's Detective Allen mysteries, and they were done in 1993 for the PBS, for BBC, actually. And I like the Thursday Club, the Thursday Murder Club mysteries. I'm steeped in mysteries and white supremacist groups and murder. Yes, that's it.
I was going to say, it seems like you, it's like all mystery all the time. You're reading it, you're writing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just finished writing a play called Ambushed. And I wrote it for a particular reason. The Contemporary Theater down in Wakefield, they have a thing called Springboard. And I had been stage managing a play of theirs, Not Much Ado About Nothing, in the fall. And they said, can you write a mystery play? Which I did. But it looks like we may use it for, at URI, there's a group that received funding from the Homeland Security. And it's the media literacy group, Courageous Conversations. You're familiar with that. They just did a Zoom program with people in regard to the Tim McVeigh book. And so they're getting interested in that aspect. They deal with critical thinking in media. But they're getting into that aspect. And they're very interested in the play where maybe the URI theater group would put the play on and we'd have experts come afterwards to discuss issues that are brought up in the play. So that's kind of where I am.
Yeah, we've talked to Courageous RI previously on the show. We'll link to that episode in the show notes if people didn't catch that first time around. But they're doing great work.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important stuff to be thinking about, how we can continue to have civil conversations about things when everything is so polarized.
Mm-hmm. You know, URI is really underrated sometimes, I think, in this state. We've got the forensics lab there, which is phenomenal. It's one of the only places where the forensics lab is situated on a campus. We've got the media group, the literacy media. They were one of the only groups that got grants from the Homeland Security. There are some amazing things. They have OSHA Lifelong Learning. Just so many things besides the teaching, the oceanography, and the business and everything else that goes on there. They're a phenomenal place. Right, Dennis?
They are phenomenal.
Thank you.
Been there since 1976, so they must mm-hmm. be phenomenal.
I've been there since 1967.
Oh, you got me beat. Okay.
I got you beat. I graduated from there.
So, Dennis, have you been watching anything interesting lately since we kind of got into TV and other media as well now?
Sure. I like the mystery things. I'm watching on Hulu, Death and Other Details. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's ongoing. It's got two more episodes. I like the Jack Reacher series that was on Prime Video. So, yeah, those kind of things. And my favorite TV show was NCIS. Basically because of Abby Shuto, right? I don't know if you remember Abby was the forensic scientist,
yes.
The goth forensic scientist. I was so sad to see her leave, but the new girl's doing pretty well too. So the science is always interesting because you want to see how far they're going to go on that branch before it breaks behind them. Because everything has a little grain of truth to it, but there's some expectations that science can't do everything that they say they can do on TV. We don't solve a murder in 55 minutes without commercials. You know, so it's that kind of thing. And we talked a lot about the CSI effect because it came out. And actually the forensic science partnership that we have at URI started just before the CSI series became popular. So there's a lot of interest in forensic sciences. And one of the reasons we created the forensic science partnership, which links our laboratory to the chemistry department, to the engineering department, to the textiles department, that has been a great series of seminars every Friday. One of the benefits of COVID to our program is that now the university records all these seminars, and they're available to be live streamed as well as to be listened to later on. Sometimes the technology doesn't work. You know, sometimes things get upset, but there's a lot of seminars that are online at the university's Forensic Science Partnership Seminar that people can look at. So one of the things I do with high school students who want to do internships, I suggest that they get their hours in by watching those seminars, or they can come and listen to them in person if they want, because the programs are open to the public. So it's one of the benefits of having the university behind us for that purpose to do these seminars. So there's lots of information out there, and they can peruse through what they want to find out. And I do get asked to come and lecture to high schools and other groups, civic groups, fraternal groups that want to listen to about the Forensic Science Partnership and the Crime Laboratory at URI.
Were you the one that opened up those sessions to the public?
Yes.
When you came in 76?
No. The Forensic Science Partnership got started in 1999. That was a effort by President Carruthers to create a partnership within the university. And I was approached by the chemistry department who wanted to get Dr. Jimmy Oxley to stay on staff. And so we created a partnership, myself, Dr. Oxley, and Dr. Chrisman from engineering. And that's when we tried to create a certificate program in forensic science. But because it had to involve additional faculty and there wasn't money for additional faculty, we went with a minor in chemistry and forensics. And we created the forensic science seminar series from that. And I said it needs to be open to the public because there's a lot of interest out there. So we created that. And it turns out that some scientists took the class for credit. A lot of people from the general public would come in.
Me.
And that's how we met. And then because URI started a criminology program, a degree program, a lot of the students taking this seminar are them because they need a science option. So it's taking a chemistry course that doesn't require them to do chemistry, but they get a chemistry credit because it's under the chemistry program. So I'd say out of the 50 or 60 people who sign up for the seminar every week for credit, they are mostly CJ students, criminal justice students. So it's a benefit to them as well. So it's an interesting place to be. And to, I've given a lot of lectures there, but we also bring in a lot of lectures. So I attend these conferences and I ask people at the conference when to come in. Claire gave a seminar at one point in time. She's going to come back and do something on Homeland Security and groups next semester.
If I'm alive.
No.
It's not the easiest research doing.
So yeah, if we have room in the show notes, we'll try to link to where people can watch the seminars. Yeah, that sounds really great.
Well, that'd be great.
Yeah, there's the link at URI. Yeah, just go to URI Forensic Science Seminar. Mm-hmm.
But it's funny that you said about students needing like a science credit. So I did my undergrad at RIC, but I did go to URI for my master's. So I'm alum at both. But they had this, you know, in their gen ed programs, there was a, you know, certain amount of kind of courses in different areas that you had to do, including like a couple. They didn't necessarily just call it like science. They had other names, but a lot of them like in it were science classes. And I took a forensic science class, like forensic science, like for undergrad, like for the non-major, just like an overview of it. Because I grew up like watching these crime shows with my parents. My parents and I watch NCIS together. We actually also watch JAG together, which people forget was the show that actually NCIS was a spinoff of.
Yeah.
But so I think there is something there to the fact that all of these crime TV shows have made people kind of very fascinated with the science behind solving crimes.
And the instructors at RIC and at CCRI that do these forensic programs are mostly law enforcement officers who were trained at our laboratory because one of the things we do on a regular basis is we train police officers in the scientific techniques of crime scene investigation. So they add that to their resume and they are able to teach there. And we also recruit people within law enforcement to teach in our classes as well. We like to have someone who's been on the job that can talk to our police officers who are the people we allow in, and they can get this specialized training. There's eventually certification if they want to go that way, but the class that we teach in the laboratory is strictly for law enforcement. The seminars are open to the public and to general students. So once in a while, I get a student who applies to take our BPS 101 or 102 class, and I have to tell them that no, it's restricted to law enforcement only.
So you've already talked a little bit about some of the things that you've done at URI, but could you talk a little bit about you recently were acknowledged within your field?
Sure. I don't work for the acknowledgments. I don't try to get something, but I was honored twice this year, actually 2023. The first was the Distinguished Forensic Scientist Award. It was given by the Henry C. Lee Institute in the University of New Haven, which runs the Arnold Markle Symposium. Now, Arnold Markle was a prosecutor for the state of Connecticut who worked a lot of forensic cases with Dr. Henry Lee. I don't know if you're people that are familiar with Dr. Lee, the wood chipper case, a lot of famous cases. He was on the O.J. Simpson case for the defense that time. So Henry is a very prominent forensic scientist, and he runs these seminars on a regular basis every year. And during these seminars, they award they provide several awards, and one of them is the Distinguished Forensic Scientist Award that I've been told is not given out every year, but has been given to a group of people who excel within the field. And I was fortunate enough to be nominated and to be approved because I asked Dr. Lee if he nominated me. He says, no, but I have veto power. So he did not veto me. So I was very honored to get that award and to accept it at the University of New Haven during the Arnold Markle Symposium. That was at the end of October. Now, the other award was given to me by the Northeast Association of Forensic Scientists, which is an association that incorporates all of New England and New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. So it's a regional organization, and they put on a seminar or a symposium or a conference every year. Now, I joined that association back in the early 80s when I was working as a toxicologist at the State Health Department and attended their meetings on a regular basis. back in the day when there was no money for travel, so you had to pay your own way, which my people don't understand that today. They all expect to get reimbursed. So I worked with that program, and I was eventually incorporated into the board, which included the executive secretary's position, being a director of the board for 3 years, then moving on to secretary of the association for 2 years, and then moving up to vice president of the association. And that was in 2005. And as vice president, you run the annual meeting. So my meeting was in Newport, Rhode Island, and it was very successful. And then I became president the next year and past president, served on the ethics committee for several years, but brought a lot of people to the conference, made sure they did it. So you're looking at 2005. So now fast forward 2023, 18 years later, and the conference is going to be in Groton, Connecticut, not too far from here, you know, stone's throw away. So I looked at the agenda. I didn't see anything on the agenda. So I wasn't going to go. So I get a phone call. Aren't you coming to the conference this year? I said, well, no, I wasn't. You ought to come to the conference this year. So why am I going to come? Well, it's important that you come to the conference this year. So not to let the cat out of the bag, he gave me a heads up that there would be an award. So I was honored to attend the conference. A lot of people at this conference, more than ever. It was a big conference. And it was the Meritorious Service Award. It's for basically giving of yourself to the association for lack of anything, you know, to whatever we had did. So as I was able to give my comments to the group that were assembled at the business meeting, I looked out over the crowd and I said to them, when I joined the association back in the early 80s, looking out over the crowd, the majority of the crowd would be male. And I said, today, and at that time, we encouraged more participation by the females who were coming into the association. I said, today you're looking out over the crowd and I see 90% female in the organization. So I said, no, we got to encourage more male participation. So it was quite a difference. And I saw Claire coming up here is that we see this in almost all the sciences, more female participation. When I started the College of Pharmacy in 1976, I'd say 90% male. Today, 80% female. So we see that gender change within the special scientists. I don't know where little guys are going. Are they going to engineering? Where are they going? But they're not coming into their hair.
Well, there's actually a decrease in men's participation in higher education in general. Yeah, I read an article maybe like 6 months ago.
So what are these guys doing?
Yeah, that it's kind of become books. Like
no, they're homemakers, Dennis. They're homemakers. They're taking care of kids.
Holy switch.
In the kitchen where they belong.
All right. Okay.
Where they barefoot.
Okay. Let's not go gender. But I was, again, honored that they would seek me out and have me give this award, because I did spend a lot of time with this organization, you know, pro bono, basically, and enjoyed going to conferences. And it was one of the past presidents that said, at least confidentially, said, we've been overlooking Dennis for quite a few years. We've got to put him up. So, again, I was honored to get the award. So they're both prominently displayed on our display case at the laboratory outside my office. So, again, was very appreciative of that. Something I didn't seek out, but was awarded.
Congratulations. It sounds like they were well-deserved.
Thank you. Eventually, I'll get a brick outside the URI library when I'm
Well, through the window.
Through the window.
Yeah, there you go.
And we'll return to the show after a quick break. Looking for another way to keep up with what's going on at the Cranston Public Library? Sign up for our email newsletter. You'll be among the first to learn about upcoming programs for kids, teens, and adults, and new services and collections coming to your library. Subscribe at cranstonlibrary.org. Looking to upgrade your computer skills? Cranston Public Library is here to help. At the Central Library, we offer computer classes throughout the month on topics like computer basics, using email, and introduction to various Microsoft programs like Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. We even offer some intermediate classes to allow you to keep leveling up your skills. We also hold open tech time Tuesday and Thursday afternoons from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Central Library, and Wednesdays 2 to 4 p.m. at the William Hall Library. At Open Tech Time, you can get one-on-one help with specific tech questions or learn how to use a new device that you just purchased. For more information about computer classes, go to cranstonlibrary.org/computers. So you've both alluded to it a little bit already, but I'm curious to hear the story of how you both met and how a forensic scientist that is maybe uncannily familiar to one of our guests today ended up in your books, Claire.
Well, I took advantage of those courses that were open to the public, the forensic seminars, and they were incredibly interesting. He brings in the most interesting people for various topics, and so you can learn quite a bit. And I took copious notes, and I did that for a while. And then, as I said, some people wanted me to write some adult books as opposed to children's set in Rhode Island. I had read plenty of mysteries, but I like facts. And so I talked to Dennis at one of the classes, and he told me, well, come on over and I'll give you a tour. So I did a tour. And then from that point on, whenever I needed information, it might be on weapons, it might be on toxic substances or trace elements or cell phone. The last one I asked was in regard to cell phones. He would either give me the information or turn me over to somebody that could. And so that's how I got started, so that I could have some factual information in my mysteries.
And lo and behold, I'm in a book.
Oh, yes. So anyhow, I was very appreciative. And whenever I'm appreciative of somebody, I put them in my book. And I don't make them the killer, and I do not kill them. So he will be alive through
good
as we
know.
Go through the book.
Good to know.
Good to know. I know. So he wasn't in the first book. He started in the second book, Last Rose on the Vine, which is actually set during a summer session in URI. And he comes in that book. And then he's in every book, but he gets more and more chapters through each book. I'm noticing he's getting to be more and more of a character. And in my play, and he wants royalties, I don't know about that. In my play, he actually has an entire scene with the mystery author, Clementine Melville, and they're friends, and he actually has an entire scene with her. And she does end up, however, she does end up sedating him to go to sleep, and he realizes that he's been sedated, and she picks up a pillow to put under his head, and he says, you're not going to smother me with that, are you? The characters are interesting, but he's taking more and more of a role as we go through the books.
I find it interesting that you said that when you appreciate someone, you put them in your books, and then obviously, you know, like you make sure that you treat them well in your books. But it's funny to me because I feel like writers a lot of times joke like, watch out or I'll put you in my book.
Well, that happens. Trust me on that.
Is a waitress going to be in your next book?
Oh, yeah.
Breakfast?
One thing that makes the books popular, I use local settings. We have a lot of historic settings, and I use those in my books, and I research them. And so I was telling Dennis, for the third book, Last Carol of the Season, my husband and I went to a local restaurant in Wakefield, and the waitress came up to the table, and she said, oh, I know you. You're the author that does the South County books. And she says to the people in the booth next to her, hey, we're reading her book now. So everybody's happy. And then she says, I have a bone to pick with you. And we know there's a problem, okay? So my husband looks like he's going to crawl under the table at this point. I said, okay. She said, you have Phil's Restaurant. You have the Muse. You have Belmont's. You have Sweeney's Liquors. You have Sweeney's Candy. You have all of these local places. Where's Melgie's? I said, oh, no problem. I said, there. The next book is set in Wakefield. There are actually two chapters with Melgie's in it.
What's your first name? That's a
just yeah. And she says, breakfast is on me. Mm. And when she walks away, my husband, who is my beta reader, said, Claire, I've read that book. Melgie's is not in that book as it is now.
Keep her promises.
And that book's already out? And
yeah, that was the third book.
It. Okay, yeah.
Oh, Melgie's is in it twice. I told them two chapters. They got two chapters. I don't mess around.
That's good. So Dennis, what did you think about the books when you saw that you were in them? And
I was honored to be part of her book. I did ask her about royalties. I don't expect royalties, but I just kid her about that. That I can claim that there's a Dennis Hill that's a professor that's in her books is an amazing little tribute to my asking her to come to the laboratory, showing her around, amazing her with making stuff that we do in the laboratory, showing her how to do fingerprint work. And yeah, it was amazing that one encounter ended up in four or five books eventually. So, and now a play that she's already asked me to be a table reader on. So we'll see what happens.
And they did for the 300th anniversary.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. That. For the 300th anniversary of South Kingstown, PBS did a special Our Town, South Kingstown. And they asked people in town to do segments. And they asked if I would do a segment on the books and the historic places in the books. And they do the similar thing that you were doing. You give them an hour's worth of information, tape, and they edit it. Well, I decided to put in interviews with two interesting people that were also part of my book and part of the settings in my book. Dennis was one of them at the forensics lab. So his segment got put in, as did the other segment. Actually, my books were kind of pushed to the side. And the two people that I interviewed, so I must be a good interviewer, I don't know, got put in. So he became famous with that PBS series.
Well, the key to that was I get a call from her. Can you find me a skeleton?
I need a skeleton.
I don't have a skeleton.
A real skeleton.
Anybody on campus have a skeleton? No. So I call up my friend, the medical examiner, Dave DeTora. I said, do you guys have a skeleton for teaching? Oh, yeah, we just bought a brand new one. He says, can I borrow it? Sure, no problem. Come up and get it. So I get this skeleton. I take him, put it in my trunk. I track him down. I tell her we have it. She comes to the lab with a couple of students, and they put it in their car. And that's the background when she says, I have a skeleton in my closet there. It was right behind her in the opening segment. And then she appeared at my lab with her iPad and was taking pictures of me, video of me as we walked through the laboratory. And that's what got the interview down. So And it wasn't until I got a text message from a friend of mine saying, hey, you're famous, you're on TV. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, the 300K series came out and you're in it.
You're in it.
Surprise. So surprise.
And the skeleton.
And the skeleton was very prominent.
We got the skeleton back in one piece.
Yes, the skeleton got back one
piece. Yes, we did.
A couple of bones came off.
No.
In my possession. Yeah. But I was able to put them back together and I didn't get hit with any penalties for returning it.
Okay.
But yes, it's something the medical examiner has for training purposes, right? Joe Bones. So that was quite the event there that she had a skeleton in her closet.
I needed an intro. And so in my house, I live in a Victorian house, and there's a bookcase in the vestibule. And the bookcase, if you touch one of the books, it opens up into the cellar. And so my intro is sitting next to the bookcase, and the bookcase opens up, and there's a skeleton right in the opening. Mm. So that's how my intro, And then you came next.
That was my contribution.
You follow the skeleton scene.
More important contribution was the skeleton.
That's right.
And being on the video.
We have not a real skeleton here. Well, over at the central branch that our social media manager likes to take out around Halloween. His name is Mort, and there's a picture somewhere saved on Facebook or my computer of Mort the skeleton standing next to the sign that says like Oaklawn Branch Library that she posted like Halloween years ago.
They're great props. Great props.
So you'll just go into her office and there's just like a skeleton like back there. So I'm curious about, I mean, both of you, Claire, I don't want to make you have to like pick favorites, but I'm curious, Dennis, if there is like your favorite kind of like murder or crime that Claire has written about, like it was a very interesting way or an interesting way that they figured out who it was. Like, do you have a particular favorite?
The rosary beads.
Yes. She mentions a part where some rosary beads were used and there was a poison in the rosary beads.
Yes, it's and I went to the pharmacy department, and it's let me see, I wrote it down here. It's Abris precatorius, or ambrum. It's a special poison that's inside seeds, and they use these seeds to make rosary beads, and the seeds are very hard. You could swallow them and not die. However, if you were to break one apart and it got into an opening, a cut, or you ingested it anyway, you would die immediately.
Exotic.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can remember, was our attorney general, Arlene Violet. Arlene Violet, who was an attorney general for the state of Rhode Island previous to that, she was a nun, a sister. So she approached me about what would be the best way to kill someone without being detected. And it's using an exotic poison, something,
yes.
You know, something that's not detectable normally in our screens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she wrote something about exotic
I asked you
well.
That same question.
Yeah, so it's on a lot of people's mind. How do I get away with murder without being caught?
Yeah, it's important.
So,
although, when you think about it, if you're in jail, you've got a lot of time to write.
Yeah.
So I guess you wasn't me.
Well, I think it was more likely is how can I get rid of someone without any being detected? So there's a lot of exotic poisons out there that they're not testing for. And unless the medical examiner or the coroner knows some effect of this drug and asked for it to be done, it's not going to be looked for, and the general screen will come back negative or none detected. We don't report negative, none detected. So an exotic poison from the South Americas or somewhere else from Southeast Asia may be an effective way to kill someone without being detected. But, I mean, today there's a lot more testing being done. If we don't find anything here in Rhode Island, it's generally sent to another laboratory that does a lot more screening just to make sure they haven't missed anything. And, of course, the police have a lot more information available to them than they did when I had. So you talked about the telephones and being able to detect where people were at certain times and locating them within certain jurisdictions, how close they were to the crimes. We just had a presentation this past Friday about cellular triangulation and how they put three suspects in a similar area to the guy who was killed and left in the Walmart parking lot. So there's a lot of new technology that's available to us today that wasn't available just back in the 80s and whatnot. And the expansion of DNA became prominent in the 90s. And DNA is being used to identify a lot of people, even if you don't have them in the database, through familial searches. So you use the 23andMe thing, if you've sent some out, but you're in a database somewhere and that it's related to a guy who committed a criminal or a female who committed a criminal, they may be able to find them that way as well. So there's a lot of new technology out there. We try to imbue our students in the police departments of what they can do in order to solve their crimes if they're available to them. So the collection and preservation of evidence becomes important and making sure you get the right evidence and send it to the right place for examinations. So it becomes very important to our physical analysis of crime scenes.
In Last Castle in the Sand, the doctor is run over by her own sports car. And the whole clue to the part of the clues to that had to do with trace evidence. And I got the inspiration from one of the lectures, the woman that you brought in from Connecticut, who talked about soil and sand and trace evidence that stays, that you can't get rid of it. It's going to be there. And so that was a major part of the clues in that book.
Yeah. For a long time, trace evidence is very important. And looking at soil. So soils on the East Bay versus West Bay are entirely different. So you might be able to put them there, or especially if they go up to Lincoln and they get the calcium deposits up there. But glass becomes sometimes unique or at least indication because most window pane glass is all the same, but glass from your headlights is different. And so you might be able to distinguish the different things. And in this case, it was headlight glass.
It was headlight glass. Yeah. So that was major for me. That led me to, because I'm always looking for solid clues where the detective actually uses something solid to wrap up the other clues besides the red herrings that you throw in. And I get a lot of help from your classes, just unique ways of murdering people and stuff is just amazing.
Well, again, we count on the criminals not being the smartest tools in the box, So because they leave mistakes behind, they leave fingerprints behind, they leave DNA behind, they leave hairs, fibers, glass, soil. All these things can be used to perhaps link them to a crime scene. You see a lot of shootings in the city of Providence, and most things they collect are cartridge casings because they're all using semi-automatic weapons. So it's important to document where the cartridge cases come from, how many guns are involved, and if it's a shootout between two different groups or the police and another group. We've had a recent case where the several police departments were involved with shooting an individual once he showed a gun. There's like 40 cartridge cases. So there's a lot of work to be done there. So again, we take the evidence of what it can be done and look at it through instrumentation, through microscopes, et cetera, and make determinations based on what we find. And then that information is given back to the police department, which then passes off to the attorney general or the prosecutor. In Rhode Island, the attorney general is the prosecutor. In most other states, is the district attorney's office. They then put the pieces together and we form one puzzle, one part of the puzzle. And then they put the rest of it together and then bring it to a jury. Because ultimately, a jury decides if it's going to go that far. It may be that you bring this evidence to this, if you talk suspect or person of interest now, and his or her lawyer, and then they decide to either plead out or go to court. And if they go to court, then it's a jury or perhaps a judge that will decide guilt or innocence based on what we bring forth and what the police bring forth in terms of the investigation. So it's really a compilation of different things from within the criminal justice community that actually solves a case.
And the way that you get the evidence, how you keep it.
Right. And it goes chain of custody.
Chain of custody. So that's important.
And it's very important that the detectives who are doing this first response, right? First responders need to protect the evidence if possible. Of course, there's life-saving issues that need to be done and may destroy evidence. But the first responders need to be protecting evidence. The criminal investigator who works for the department, in most cases as a police officer, is going to collect evidence. And then eventually it's brought to our laboratory, the health department laboratory, or you might get the FBI involved, you may get ATF involved, you may get the secrets, all sorts of federal agencies involved. And then they do the analysis and it's brought back to the police department to then present it to the lawyers who then go forward with that to present. Because all this information that we gather is absolutely available to the defense, right? Defense gets all. Now, the defense may do their own investigation. They may have their own investigators to look at the cases, may have their own forensic scientists that can look at the case. But whatever they found is not necessarily turned back over to the prosecutor. So it's important that we are upfront and not be biased in the way we present our evidence.
I found the day that we went in, and I was asking you about trace evidence, not in particular to the glass at that point, but it was another, it was the third mystery, and I needed to know about trace evidence from clothing. And you showed me how they bring it into this room and they put it, but there was a machine that you said you wished you had at the time that would have made the job easier. It was a vacuum. It's a type of vacuum.
All right. So there's a couple of things on the horizon and it turned out to be not so important after all. But there is something called a MVAC, which helps to extract DNA from articles of clothing. So it uses kind of like your vacuum at home that uses the water power to clean up your carpets. But this is specifically to collect DNA samples from within clothing. It may be distributed because as you think you wear your clothing, you're going to see a lot of DNA from the collar, but not so much from down here. But you have touched this area and we can probably increase our DNA concentration by using this MVAC. Even though it was marketed to be a very valuable tool, it turns out that a lot of the DNA examiners don't find it to be as valuable as the manufacturer thought it was. So, in fact, a detective had started a GoFundMe thing to try to raise money so we'd buy it. And I said, okay, I'll match your money, but it has to be given to the health department because they do the DNA. And when I talked to the supervisor who ran the DNA laboratory, he says, really, it's not that valuable. So we're not going to be looking to institute it. But there is something called a 90-minute DNA analysis, that's something that's being touted now. But it still needs a lot of DNA before it can be put into place. So there are things that go on that say, okay, this might be valuable. They turn out to not to be as valuable as you thought. Mm-hmm. One of the things we tried to get in the laboratory for many years was a scanning electron microscope. In most cases, when you look at a light microscope, you're looking at 40x, 50x, maybe 100x if you're looking at biologicals. We needed a scanning electron microscope to look at 300,000x because we're looking at very tiny particles. And we wanted to have an X-ray machine attached to it so we can actually identify the elements that were present. Most common material we would use this in with gunshot residue. When you fire a gun, the powder from the back of the gun will deposit upon the shooter's hand. And if the police did collect that quickly enough, we can then say they recently fired a weapon. And the scanning electron microscope was the best means to do that. We had to send our samples out for analysis if we wanted to do that at a high cost. So eventually we collected some grant money and we collected other monies and we said we'll buy this instrument. So in October of 2022, we actually bought the instrument for $300,000. And it's in place now and being used for gunshot residue. But that also could be used for the analysis of paints. So think of a hit and run case where paint is transferred from the suspect vehicle to the other vehicle and the suspect vehicle takes off. So the paint there can be analyzed by the SEM to see what the elements are. It can be compared to a paint database to tell you perhaps the make and model of the car that was from. And then when the police perhaps find a suspect vehicle, we can compare the two together to confirm that the paint left behind is similar to the paint that's from that vehicle and that had damage consistent with it. Of course, if you find now biological materials on that car, you're going to do DNA, you're going to do hairs and fiber analysis. So that's very important. So that's one of the pieces of instrument that we have developed within the last couple of years.
This is the kind of information that Dennis and I will sit and talk about, besides giving a tour of the lab and talking to other experts. He explains this kind of thing to me so that I know what's out there and whatever. And then I get little tips like from the person who does fingerprints. He took my hand one day, and I'm old, and he looked at it and he said, old people could get away with murder if it has to do with fingerprints because their fingerprints wear down. Do you ever wonder why you drop things a lot? And I said, yeah. He said, because yours are really smooth. And I thought, well, that's good to know. And then there was another time, I don't remember who told me, but you get credit for it in one of the books, where we're talking about the best way to drown a person. And the best way to drown a person is to drag the person by the ankles. Because you can't leave any marks on the person's body. You drag them by the ankles underwater. So little tiny things like little discussions that come up can be very, very helpful when you're doing a scene to make it realistic.
And that's why we do our class only for law enforcement, so we don't pass this on.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. Yeah.
Want to drag people by the ankles.
Yeah, we
sound
don't.
Like a crocodile or an alligator would do that. Yeah.
You really don't want to pass this info on.
But you're doing your book, so that's okay.
Yeah, as long as it's between the pages, that's right.
So earlier, we're talking about how technology seems to have made things a lot easier, not only technology in the field, but also the fact that we carry something around in our pocket that tells whoever looks at it after where we've been. But I wonder, on the flip side of it, has technology made it harder to write mysteries, in your opinion, Claire? Has it become harder to like write around cell phones and things like that?
Well, it could if you let it. The first thing that you need to do when you write a book, whether it be a children's book or an adult mystery, is you have to decide who your audience is and what your language is going to be. And do you want to be technical or do you want to try to keep it simple, stupid? I'm not saying that my readers are stupid. They're very smart, actually. People that read mysteries, there's a puzzle. And it takes a little bit more work than other genres. But I feel if you keep it simple, you don't have to get into all the technical aspects. And so that's what I try to do. I go through information, and then where Kara is working with Professor Hill in the lab, I keep it simple. And I put in some interesting things, but I don't go into total detail. Although I want to know what the detail is, I don't feel I have to go into it for my readers. It's not going to add to the book for them.
Hmm. And you don't just need your cell phone to find out where you are. They're going to ping off of towers, and
that's
the towers
right.
can tell you where you are.
Yep. That's what happened in that book, The Tower Told.
Don't you go to ChatGPT and have the AI write you a paragraph?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to turn it over to some. I'm a control freak. Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to AI. That's good.
So I know there's probably, we were kind of more focused on the book and your relationship. So I know there's probably a lot more that our audience could know about forensic science in general, but is there anything kind of to the purview of this episode, anything that you were hoping that we would touch on that you want our audience to know that we didn't hit on today?
We covered it. Set up okay. a good relationship.
I didn't know what to expect at all. So
set up a good relationship with the director of the crime lab and you're all set. You can get any information you want.
Not that I expect a whole bunch of people to be calling me for tours.
No, no.
We do offer tours on a regular basis, usually after 4 o'clock and to small groups. For when we need to go out and talk to high schools who have forensic programs, I generally go to them with a PowerPoint. That's basically a virtual tour of the laboratory, showing them what we do, as well as what's done within the forensic science community in Rhode Island. Because as you remember, there's a separation between us and the group in Providence, which does the drug chemistry, the toxicology chemistry, and the DNA for the state. It's all out of the health department. So the medical examiner's office uses that laboratory extensively. The law enforcement sends all their solid dose drugs there. And, of course, any DNA that we develop in our laboratory is sent there as well. So every gun crime that comes into our laboratory is swabbed for DNA, because touch DNA, we talked about that earlier, because we want to put the gun in someone's hand, basically, right? So DNA is the way to do that. Very often we don't find fingerprints on firearms because of the way they're made and the way they're handled. Even if they touch the cartridges that go in, because the heat created by the firing of a gun destroys the fingerprint exam, but it doesn't necessarily destroy all the DNA. So DNA has been more successfully developed from firearms weapons. And that's our biggest caseload right now, our firearms cases coming into the laboratory, although it's gone down substantially in the last year or so. My hope at some point in time is that they become a consolidated laboratory in Rhode Island at the University of Rhode Island. So if anyone's listening to that and has the power to do that, I'm happy to talk to them about that.
All right. So we wrap up the show with a segment I call The Last Chapter, where we talk about a library or bookish related question. And I thought I would ask you both, where is your favorite place to read?
Mm. My front porch.
You like your front porch?
That's a good
one. I have a big front porch. Mm. Comfortable chairs. I like it there.
We have a counter in my kitchen where I will sit with the computer and read there. Also, there's a TV up to the right side, so I'm distracted watching TV, but most of the time I'm reading on the computer itself, mostly news things. Like I said, I keep up with the news because I want to see what's going to come to the laboratory the next day. Okay, mm-hmm. There was a hit and run the night before. There was a shooting the night before. There was a robbery the
An
night before.
An explosion the day before.
So we have a new person in our laboratory just out of college. I said, don't you watch the news? He says, no. I said, but you should watch the news because it's very important for you to watch the news. I said, why? Because you don't know what's coming next day. When you watch the news, next day Providence is going to show up with that case, and you should know what's in the media, what's going on in that case. So it's important. I mean, when I was in high school, we had to watch the news. We had to report on the news almost every day. It's a different world again today. But so, again, most of my reading is online, and I'm sitting at my kitchen table either doing reading or writing or doing reports or listening to TV and CIS, the old ones with Gibbs.
Not to throw in one last question, but you talking about watching the news made me think of it. Like, so being so kind of like embedded in crime that you're watching the news and then a lot of times you're seeing, you know, the evidence come in the next day. Does it make you, I guess, how do you deal with like the emotions related to that? Like, does it make you feel afraid of crime or do you feel prepared to respond to crime because of what you do?
Yeah, I feel prepared. I mean, I'd much rather be in the know than not in the know. I'd rather be expecting something than not expecting something. So occasionally some things come in that don't hit the news, which we have to keep quiet. And of course, I'll get asked about things. But again, I can't respond to anything outside of law enforcement. So it's important that I know what's going on in the state and what's going on in different areas, too, because what happens in Massachusetts or Connecticut may affect us as well. Things that happen on a national basis in Congress may affect us as well. Changes in laws may affect us. So we need to keep aware of that. There's an organization now that's run out of NIST. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology that oversees the standardization of a lot of the methods within the forensic science community because it's been very not regulatory throughout the United States. We may be doing something with trace evidence here that they're not doing in California, or they vice versa. So this organization of forensic science communities will create standards to guide us in our analysis. And one of the things I was involved with was in report writing and testimony for all the standards. And so that's very important that we kind of standardize that. So everyone's doing the same thing throughout the country so that we're well-regulated. The other thing is you need to know what's going on in other states because the defense community may be picking up on it. And we may be questioned about our results based on a defense person going across state lines and learning about something else. So we need to be prepared and ready to respond to any questions that come up, either from the prosecution or defense or from law enforcement, and be ready to help them understand what we do and how we can help them get the answers that they need.
But I was thinking more of like you personally, do you feel like unsafe or?
No, I don't. Maybe because I've become numb to it. I don't know. But basically, I expect that these things will happen. And I expect they won't happen to me, which is probably wrong-headed thinking. But I do have my guard up watching things. So I'm more aware of my surroundings, making sure I know where the exits are, knowing where what I need to do if something happens. But I don't expect it to happen, so I don't worry about it. That's my wife's job.
Maybe the more healthy outlook, especially with the type of work that you
right.
do.
Yeah, exactly. What do they say? Que sera, sera?
Whatever will be.
All right.
Well, thank you both for joining me. And thank you, everyone, for listening. If you'd like to respond to our last chapter question or just to reach out to the show, you can do that via email at downtime@cranstonlibrary.org. You can also reach out to us via social media with the hashtag DowntimeCPL. If you're feeling generous, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts because it helps people find the show. Thank you again for listening, and this has been another episode of Downtime. Downtime is a project of the Cranston Public Library and is produced by Elena Rios, Robin Nizio, and me, Taylor Cardillo. Audio engineering by Dave Bartos. Our theme music is Day Trips by Ketza. And our ad music is Happy Ukulele by Scott Holmes. Links to the books and movies discussed can be found in the show notes. Remember to rate and review Downtime on Apple Podcasts, connect with the podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram with the hashtag DowntimeCPL, and if there's something you'd like to hear on the show, send an email to downtime@cranstonlibrary.org. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are the speaker's own and do not represent those of the Cranston Public Library. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. The Cranston Public Library name, in all forms and abbreviation, are the property of its owners, and its use does not imply endorsement or opposition to any specific organization, product, or service. The content of this episode is the property of the Cranston Public Library and may not be reproduced without express written permission. Join us next week for more Downtime.
So, does this happen? You want to edit this out?
Yeah, no problem.
So I can church, turn it off.